before it's too late.
Former Trump supporter Stephen Ayers and former Oath Keepers spokesperson Jason Van Tatenhoff, questioned by Congressmember Jamie Raskin. And this is Vice Chair Liz Cheney in her closing remarks.
You will hear that Donald Trump never picked up the phone that day to order his administration to help. This is not ambiguous. He did not call the military. His Secretary of Defense received no order. He did not call his Attorney General. He did not talk to the Department of Homeland Security. Mike Pence did all of those things. Donald Trump did not. We will walk through the events of January 6th next week, minute by minute. And one more item. After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us. And this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney, Vice Chair of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. The next public hearing is next week, Thursday, July 21st. Democracy Now! Will live stream it at democracynow.org, as we have all the public hearings, and you can go to all of them at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Karl Marxer. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeyer.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland. Everybody, this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. I'm your weekly host, Paul Roland. And that was a group called Bootleg Orchestra. And I will ask my guests to talk a little bit about that group. My guests today are Copeland Downs and Gabe Penk. Downs is a member of the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines, a grassroots organization committed to defending human rights and building a just and lasting peace in the Philippines. Penk is a member of Kalikasan Solidarity Organization, a Portland-based environmental justice group fighting in solidarity with peasants, indigenous people, and land and water defenders in the Philippines. Both KSO and PCHRP are member organizations of the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines, a solidarity network of concerned organizations and prominent individuals campaigning for human rights and just and lasting peace in the Philippines. They launched an international observer mission prior to the 2022 national elections in response to calls for international solidarity from the Filipino people in their struggle to assert their basic civic and political rights. 11 Portland-based members of KSOP-CHRP, as well as people organizing for Philippine Solidarity and the International Women's Alliance, recently returned from 2 weeks in the Philippines, helping to contribute to their final report of the 2022 Philippine election, which did elect the son of the should-be-disgraced former dictator Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines. But the Marcos family is back in power, following up on the brutal Duterte regime. Not good. So we are looking at the Philippines with a Portland connection. And good morning, Gabe and Copeland.
Good morning.
Good morning, Paul.
So yeah, talk about that. Get a little bit closer to the mic.
Sure.
So the bootleg orchestra that played that carry on the fight, who are they? Where are they from?
Yeah, Bootleg Orchestra is out of Los Angeles, Long Beach, and they make a lot of music focusing on people's struggles, specifically in the Philippines, and bringing attention to the issues that people are fighting for globally.
So the Philippines is obviously of great geostrategic importance. Maybe people don't know that. It has a long, long history of association, and not good ones generally, with the United States. And we'll get into all that. But first of all, neither of you have Philippine ancestry. So what is it that got you interested in human rights in the Philippines and people's struggles? And how did you get involved in this work?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's always funny to answer because, yeah, we're both two tall white guys. So when we're able to see each other in person, I always joke about the, you know, not being Filipino and everything. But I think for me, I was actually raised Quaker, which gave kind of a strong basis of anti-war and kind of an understanding of how tax dollars are being used to fund wars, you know, globally and things like that. And so over time, sort of had some friends who were involved in connecting that strand to the way that the U.S. is doing that currently, which is giving a lot of military aid to the Philippines. And as I sort of learned more about that, kind of got pulled in by the National Democratic Movement, and we can talk more about that in a second. But so that was kind of my way in, and just being able to express that here locally has been kind of a place of not just fighting for the Philippines, but linking that with other struggles, solidarity movements in other parts of the world. So. That's kind of how I got involved.
And that was Copeland. And I'm not sure your mic is working. Your voice might be coming through another mic.
Okay.
But let me hear Gabe's voice.
Sure.
I think there's a problem there. So we'll try to work on that. Okay. Go ahead, Gabe.
Sure. I can introduce myself. I'm Gabe. I'm a member of Kalikasan Solidarity Org. And I got involved in the movement. I have been interested and following a lot of indigenous struggles here in North America around environmental issues, and meeting people from the National Democratic Movement in the Philippines brought my attention to how interconnected these struggles are. The movement for national democracy in the Philippines has been around for decades, has a really strong and rich history, both in the Philippines and in the U.S. and internationally, actually, and does an excellent job of linking issues of human rights and environmental issues and anti-imperialist issues. And so seeing the work that organizers were doing here in Portland around those, also connecting to Palestinian liberation, to land back, and to indigenous people's rights around the world, just made me really excited to see the work that's being done and wanting to join that. And like Copeland mentioned, for those of us who are not Filipino, this is also important for all of us, especially in the U.S., to bring attention to the way that the U.S. is funding and involved in the exploitation and the plunder of the Philippines, and that these global struggles are very much connected, and we all have a role to play in that.
Mm-hmm. I apologize to listeners if there's some background noise. We're still trying to get Copeland on a functioning mic. Hopefully, that'll happen soon. So I guess we'll keep talking to Gabe in the meantime. So, so it must have been a real amazing experience getting to the Philippines. It's a long way away. It's, people haven't been traveling much to begin with for the last few years. So I don't know if that's the first time you've been on an airplane in a while. Anyway, there just must have been quite the experience. So, first of all, what were the objectives of the trip to the Philippines?
Yeah, I think I don't know if my microphone.
Why don't you just go and share the one with Kate? Just get up real close.
There all right,
go.
Cool. We're all friends here, so So I think to start off and kind of frame this whole thing, the International Observers Mission came out of a project that had happened previously, kind of in response to the UN's kind of lack of follow-up in their accountability measures for, they passed a resolution to look into the human rights violations under Duterte, but have really kind of faced a challenge in pursuing that. And so iChirp Global actually launched a thing called Investigate PH, which was an independent project to hold, to hear from people on the ground and hear their stories about human rights violations and different things like that. And that was kind of through the course of 2020. And so going into the election cycle in the Philippines, the part of that project or part of the Investigate PH project led to the calls for observers missions. And so that was kind of the basis of why this happened. And, so the objectives are really to send international observers to bear witness to what was going on both before, during, and after the election. So the whole process was actually like 5 months. There were different teams from around the U.S. and around the world who sent delegations to be involved. Really to sort of do interviews with people, observe polling stations and precincts, kind of the various ways of bearing witness to what's going on and kind of hear from people on the ground their experiences and the different things that were happening around the election. So I'm not sure if you have more to add, but yeah.
Yeah, the outcome of the report as well, they released two different reports, an interim report midway through the election observers mission and then a final report, which was released on the 28th of June. And so based on all of the various groups that went to the Philippines, including ours was one of the last groups, included 11 of us from Portland specifically, and was broken up into two different groups that were sent to different parts of the Philippines to speak with people and witness the conditions. And the final election observers report, basically the overall general findings were that the elections in the Philippines were not free and fair. That we documented many, many instances of corrupt and fraudulent elections, including widespread vote buying, rampant red tagging, which is the method the government uses to discredit and to terrorize people's organizations and activists and critics of the government. So they will label organizations or individuals as terrorist or communist and discredit them and often put a target on their back. Can often lead and often does lead to arrests and also extrajudicial killings of those people who have been red tagged. So that was a common practice throughout the election period. And then finally, a massive disinformation campaign, especially on the part of Marcos Jr.'s team to both rewrite the history of his father, Ferdinand Marcos Sr., and to, again, discredit and to other opposition candidates.
Yeah, and just to flag that red tagging thing, you told me before the show that's actually also happened to activists here in the United States. So we'll get into that as we go along. I know that's the long arm of national security agents has all right. Not just Russia is involved in that. Obviously Khashoggi of the targeted by the Saudis, And I think back in the 70s, a Chilean was killed in the United States by Chilean agents. And yeah, that sort of thing goes on. So it's nothing to laugh about, certainly nothing to ignore. Anyway, so you guys were in the Philippines, and I'm really struck by how I've always been struck since I got back to Portland after a long time away. I got back in 2012. I was really impressed with how active especially the young Philippine community and the activists in the community and their allies were in Portland in the activist scene. Seems to be one of the kind of the more radical, more stronger components of the activist scene. I was really kind of surprised by that. But you know, Portland does have a large Filipino population, and there's actually, you know, you talk about the movement around the world. There's actually a really large Philippine diaspora throughout the world, like a lot of other, you know, victims of American and European colonialism. There's a lot of people. And the subsequent, you know, devastation, economic devastation, and often political and human rights suppressions, like in the Philippines, there's a lot of people fleeing for all those reasons. So talk a little bit about, you know, both Portland, the West Coast, and worldwide, just the how many Filipinos there are. And also, I guess, connected to the pandemic, how many Filipino nurses there are.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so this is only an hour, right? Well, I mean, I think, yeah, that's a good point that there's Filipinos around the world. It's pretty well known and documented. And I think one of the important pieces about that to understand is that it's tied up in the economics, too, of the systematic export of Filipino labor globally. And that's part of the reason, too, I think there's such a strong global solidarity movement is that you know, 1 in 10 Filipinos lives outside of the Philippines. And that's like, you know, however many millions of people that are working in oil fields in the Middle East, and seafarers are a big population of overseas Filipino workers, and nurses, like you mentioned. And so, yeah, I think we really have to look at the economics of that. It's not an accident that, you know, the Philippines was kind of a colony of the U.S. They took over from Spain at the turn of the century. And then
the Spanish-American War.
Yeah, right. And America just, you know, or Spain kind of sold the Philippines to the U.S. And then we took over as the colonizers there.
along with Puerto Rico.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that was all kind of connected there. And really, you know, the U.S. was brutal in that campaign to subjugate the Filipino people. And so post World War II, when, you know, the U.S. quote unquote granted independence to the Philippines,
because Japan had taken over.
Yeah. And there was, you know, the Philippines kind of resistance to the Japanese Imperial Army was fierce. And then the U.S. took credit for it, you know, so it's this type of pattern. But really what happened then was that the Philippines transitioned from a direct colony to a neo-colony. And so the U.S. had to find ways of exerting their economic and political control. And one of the ways they did that was by sort of helping set up the labor export policy, which is a series of kind of policies, economic policies and different things that make it really easy for Filipinos to go abroad. So, you know, one aspect of that we can see now is that most young Filipinos are taught English as their first language, and that helps them, you know, be a part of the global workforce as opposed to like learning local languages or mother tongues, you know, and things like that. And so we can kind of see like the cultural imperialism there, but also the economics of seeing the Philippines as kind of a reserve army of labor, basically, that gets exported. So, yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of Filipinos abroad in the U.S. You know, the West Coast is a really active. I think Seattle probably has claim to more like active organizers. I think there were a handful of folks who were doing a lot of good work in the 70s and were actually assassinated for it. So there's kind of like a long history there. But yeah, Portland, I think, you know,
Filipinos who were in the United States were assassinated?
Yeah, yeah.
When they went back to the Philippines?
No, in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I was saying earlier was really to the mark.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's unfortunately, it's not new. And that's kind of the really kind of dark history and frustrating piece of the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, Filipinos have been involved in everything from labor strikes, the Delano grape strikes in California, historically, and different things like that. So the movement here has been strong for a number of years. In Portland, I think, my understanding and introduction to PCHRP, the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines, was that PCHRP was started in 2005 in response to the 2004 Hacienda Luisita massacre. So Hacienda Luisita is a place. It's a big sugar plantation that's kind of north of Manila. And it was a piece of land that had been kind of taken in like the 50s to the Aquino family. The Aquino sounds familiar. It's because there have been multiple Aquino presidents, which kind of points to the relationship between the political and the economic system there. But over time, president after president sort of denied giving back these farmers their land. And it kind of came to a head in 2004 when farmers were peacefully striking for, honestly just wage hikes, actually, and were met with police violence. There was like 7 or 8 people murdered, many more injured. So kind of the classic, rocks and sticks met with bullets. That was a struggle for their land. And that's kind of emblematic of the Philippines' struggle. There were organizers who went and did fact-finding missions in response to that massacre. And when they came back to Portland, saw the need to build kind of a Philippine political expression of resistance to that. And so started PCHRP. And over time, that's evolved and become much more active in kind of the 2010s. But we see now we've launched, a ton of organizations. So we can, give all the handles later and get people connected. But that's kind of been the long history of organizing in Portland, I think.
Mm-hmm. So obviously it's we all struggle to be, to have some sort of influence and try to have some success, which is often difficult in political mm-hmm. organizing in this world as it is. And obviously when you're dealing with, from the Marcos regime to, they had an interim period where they actually had some more reform-minded presidents, and then Duterte came along, and now we're back to Marcos again. Mm. But anyway, so it must be good to be active with a group that really has a strong spirit and has a lot of activity going on.
Yeah, I think the for a lot of people, especially Solidarity Allies, code for white people, the National Democratic Movement, the organizing framework is one of the pieces that I think catches a lot of people because it is so disciplined and sort of methodical, as opposed to sort of being like, flare up and then kind of die down. And so I think that's one piece that stood out for me. I don't know if Gabe, you want to share more?
I was just gonna to follow up on what you were saying about the movement and about kind of, the problem of the Philippines is the Philippines' lack of independence and just continued oppression by the U.S. and other foreign powers is something that's been centuries in the making, and the resistance has also been just that long. And the movement that we're all part of, the National Democratic Movement, which includes both Solidarity organizations as well as Philippine organizations based in the Philippines and around the world amongst the Philippine diaspora. But like Copeland was talking about, we in the movement see three core root problems as being the foundation of what we're trying to address. And these problems go deep, identifying them and making them a part of our organizing is our ultimate goal. And those three problems are number one, imperialism, which is the control and the appropriation of Philippine wealth by other foreign powers, namely and most mostly the U.S. We also have the problem of a really corrupt political system. It's called bureaucrat capitalism is how it's termed in the movement, which is essentially, like Copeland is saying, that the political system in the Philippines is dominated by wealthy landlord clans and family dynasties. So we see the Aquino family having multiple family members in power, now the Marcoses, of course. And, you know, currently in this election, there were multiple family members from both of those political dynasties elected, not only to the president, but to the senators. And so the political system is not in the service of the people. It's in the service of the 1% in the Philippines, which is then also in service of the U.S. And then finally, the last root problem is feudalism, which is the structure that keeps the majority of people in the Philippines in poverty and without land. So 75% of Filipino people are peasants. They don't own the land that they work, and therefore they do not get to see the value that they create through their work. And this poverty, this extreme poverty, is what, you know, drives a lot of the overseas Filipino workers, the need to travel outside the Philippines for work in order to sustain their families, and once again feeds the countries that exploit the Philippines. So the U.S. gains a lot of cheap labor that way, and that's, you know, in the U.S. As an imperial country, it's in the U.S.'s interest to maintain those systems.
And this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular weekly host of this program, and I have two guests in the studio, actually. It's the first time in, gosh, 2.5 years that I've actually had live guests in the studio, which is kind of remarkable. So congratulations.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
Anyway, and they are Copeland Downs and Gabe Penk, and they are members of two of the Portland-based solidarity groups with the Philippines, Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines, in Copeland's case, and the Kalikasan Solidarity Organization, which is a Portland-based environmental justice group fighting in solidarity with peasants, indigenous people, and land and water defenders in the Philippines. And well, we got a couple things I want to get into, is specifically some of the issues. I know there's mining issues, and obviously the human rights have to do with the suppression of the people who are struggling against the imperialism, corrupt politics, and feudalism. And I also want to get specifically into the fact that we do have the Marcos dynasty back in power, remarkably, and the whole series of lawsuits against trying to recoup that money, which now seems to be moot since Marcos is actually back in power, which is obviously part of his design. But I want to also give out the number, because this is a call-in program, and you have just about half an hour now. And if you want to call, try to call early rather than later, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. That's the number to call in and make your comment, ask your question of Copeland and Gabe. So yeah, let's, just so we don't let it go till the very end, Marcos. It's astounding. The ability of, the Philippine people are intelligent people. You know, human beings are intelligent creatures. Yet we are so tend to be swayed, as we were in this country in electing Trump, and unfortunately so many other political leaders. But just how did Marcos get back in power? Was it, however many years of Duterte? Was it, I heard there was a really strong social media propaganda campaign. Talk about, the Marcos legacy, efforts to get the money back, and Ferdinand Marcos Jr. named Bongbong getting into power.
Again, I mean, we only have a half an hour. there's so many aspects of this that kind of made it happen, right? So one of the big things, Gabe kind of mentioned disinformation, and one of the things about the disinformation campaign is that that's also not new. So it's not just that disinformation started at the beginning of this election cycle, but there has been the systematic rewriting of the martial law era in the Philippines. So, you know, for Marcos Sr., who waged a brutal campaign of martial law, you know, disappearing thousands and thousands of people, murdering and torturing thousands and thousands of people, this was a horrible time for the Filipino people. But the way that it's taught today is that it was like the golden era of the Philippines. And, you know, part of what we studied before we left actually was sort of what are people learning about and hearing. And one of the things that we sort of had to be sharp about is there were areas in the Philippines, like Marcos's hometown and that region, where there were development projects that were carried out in ways that, you know, really supported the bureaucrat capitalist aspect of the economy, but people saw that as like a positive thing. And so we actually heard in a couple places with people that I interviewed, like we heard people reflect that and sort of say like, oh no, we thought, you know, Marcos, that era was great because we saw like roads being built and infrastructure developing and those types of things. But the reality is that was a very small, like a small part of the overall problem that Marcos posed, right? Which was, you know, suspending the election cycle and declaring martial law and then murdering thousands of people. And
amassing a vast fortune.
Yeah, stealing, I mean, billions and billions of dollars. There was some report that mentioned that Marcoses count their money in U.S. dollars as opposed to pesos. And they still have 10 billion U.S. dollars, which is insane. I mean, that's wealth that they're stealing from people on the ground. So, I mean, you know, doing all these horrible things, but the way that's being taught in the education system, because these political dynasties have a grip on the education system as well, sort of instilling and rewriting history to make it look like this was the golden era of the Philippines. And so for a lot of people today, there aren't the sort of red flags that go up when they hear, you know, Marcos or whatever, despite, you know, his campaign, Bongbong's campaign had like zero policy points. Like he did not have a political platform to stand on. It's insane. In the same way that like Trump didn't really have a political platform beyond just kind of demagoguery. There were people who were clearly favorites. The previous vice president, Lenny Robredo, was a favorite and was mobilizing thousands of people to rallies, and had, you know, some sort of platform at least. I think there's definitely criticism there too, but at least there was something, and Bongbong was providing nothing. But because of this sort of the systematic rewriting of history, people didn't sort of internalize that quite the same way. And so then it leads to this sort of like glorification of Marcos and that era and things like that, that can be really deceiving for people on the ground. I think that's a part of it. I'm not sure if you want to add more, but...
I also neglected to re-mention that both of you just returned from a trip to the Philippines. So when you're talking about interviewing people, you're actually talking about on the ground there in the Philippines. And we do have a caller, Eric, but go ahead, Gabe, go ahead and finish the thought, and we'll get to our first caller in a minute.
Sure. I'll just say a little bit more about the vote buying, which is also a big piece of this election, and that we heard a lot from people there about how this works. So vote buying is illegal in the Philippines, yet it's never prosecuted, and it's a way of, you know, it's buying people's votes. So it takes form in different ways, but essentially it's politicians handing out cash to voters, and so that they will vote for particular candidates. And there's different ways that this gets enforced. Obviously, like, some ways, you know, voters could potentially take the cash and vote however they want, but there are ways that a community that whose votes have been bought by a particular candidate, they can check the records and see whether that percentage, whether they did indeed vote in favor of a candidate or not. And if not, they're often subject to harassment and intimidation by various forces. Lots of politicians, you know, hire goons and other private forces to harass and intimidate voters. And political violence, just in general, is something that very much undermines any sort of democratic process. And, you know, we heard about in my region, I was in Mindanao, which is the southern island in the Philippines. There have been some horrendous cases of political violence in the past, including a massacre of over 50 journalists and human rights defenders in 2009. This was a case of rival political clans and just the murder of people supporting an opposition candidate who were filing for his certificate of candidacy. Still seeking justice for the people who were killed in that, but clearly an example of the difficulty of people taking power and opposing the political structure already in place.
Well, let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, Eric. You are on the air.
Hello.
Yep. Go ahead.
I'm just catching parts of what you're saying. But you know, the facts are one fact that is omitted is the Philippines is the largest Christian country in Asia. And the religion of a country has a lot to do with how progressive they are. And, you know, and all the consequences and problems that come about. Of course, it's been Catholic country for a long time. And you can see in their attitudes and their thoughts and their endeavors and their politics, you know, of who they are. But yeah, I think religion has a lot to do with a country, and I think they work with the political powers as well. Anyway, enjoy your show.
Okay.
I can just respond a little in short to that. You're right to say that the Philippines is a predominantly Catholic country, and that's, you know, roots of the Spanish colonial era. I wouldn't say that that's what determines the political structure or the political outcomes in the country. In fact, the region where I was, we met many organizers who work within various church groups who are quite progressive and are the folks on the ground who are opposing these multinational mining corporations, who are standing up for peasant rights, for workers' rights. Just to name a few of these, the United Methodist Church, the United Church of Christ, as well as Iglesia Filipina Independiente, IFI, which is independent, broke off from the Roman Catholic Church in the Philippines to create a national church. And all of these groups are quite active in political sphere and often targeted for it. So many members of the IFI have been red tagged, have even been killed by the Duterte government for the political work that they do. So you're right that religion is quite prevalent in the Philippines, but it can take many different forms. So,
yeah, I was thinking earlier of, you know, I had a man from Colombia on a month ago or so talking about the recent Colombian elections, which elected a leftist president and vice president, part of what's called a pink tide, which is really quite remarkable. I mean, like 10 or a dozen countries now have left-wing progressive governments of varying kinds, but particularly the people in Colombia really impressed me. Anyway, those are, you know, heavily Catholic countries as well, generally in Latin America, and it just struck me that they're, you know, in the 80s, when there's these movements for anti-colonial movements, anti-neo-colonial movements, revolutionary movements in El Salvador, Nicaragua. The only successful one was Nicaragua. They were kind of the first wave of left-wing resistance, I guess. Although it goes way, way back. But anyway, so there were, just speaking of the religious question, there were actually, there's a liberation theology movement had always a minority force, but had a certain strength and actually, you know, was part of the repression against them, but also a big part of the upsurge of resistance. Some of the organizing was coming from the progressive Christian movements. Anyway, has there been anything parallel in the Philippines, like in terms of liberation theology?
I recommend people look into, it's called Theology of Struggle. I was also turned on to this when I was there, and have more research to do myself, but like you're saying, very much connected to liberation theology.
Yeah. And 503-231-8187 before we give it back to Copeland, 503-231-8187. You only have 20 minutes, so get your calls in the next 5-10 minutes if you want.
Yeah, I just jump in on the liberation theology piece because, yeah, like Gabe said, you know, the UCC and the UMC have been, you know, really in the fight too. It's not like the separate thing. I think that's the sort of incredible thing about the history and legacy of the liberation theology movement is that there's the understanding, the basic understanding is that before people, you know, it's like a hungry stomach has no ears, right? Like hungry people who are facing oppression are, you know, they have a different relationship with God than people who are in positions of leadership and power. I think that, you know, that really stands out in the Philippines. One of the places that I got to go when we were there was the Union Theological Seminary, which is sponsored by the UMC and the UCC Philippines. And they're a progressive seminary. And we got to talk with one of the professors there who said that, like, one of the first things that they do with the incoming class of students is take them to People's State of the Nation Address, which is one of the biggest protest rallies in the Philippines annually. So there's every year the president gives a State of the Nation Address. And in response to that, there's a People's State of the Nation, which is, you know, the number of sectors, you know, everything from teachers to professionals to peasant organizations, workers organizations, and also church folks who were, really saying, like, this is, you know, we're facing exploitation and oppression, and this is not of God, this is not what Jesus was saying, and things like this. And so, I think just, you know, it looks different than it does, or religion and kind of faith tradition looks different in countries that have faced the history of colonization and imperialism than it does in a country like the U.S., which is an imperial power. So I think, it's really inspiring, actually, and it's really a critical piece of kind of the movement there. So
let's go to our next caller. We got Dana on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm just wondering, because I guess you guys were interviewing different people of different communities, so I'm just curious to know more about, like, what were the issues that those communities were facing? What were the issues that were most important to the people you were talking to?
Yeah, thank you, Dana. I'll speak first on that. I was, like I said, in southern Mindanao, a really big issue for people there. That's a largely agricultural area. We see Dole having huge influence in the region, Dole Fruit Company. So massive pineapple and banana plantations, all for export. So the labor conditions there on these plantations are one really big issue. We met workers actually at a Dole packing plant who had been laid off for organizing a union, have been fighting to get their jobs back now for 2 years. So labor conditions being a huge issue, as well as the lack of land, like we're saying, the land reform being a crucial issue of people to be able to have access to land, to be able to earn their living and not be dependent on these foreign multinational corporations. And then another crucial issue, this is widespread in the Philippines and it's specifically in Mindanao, is mining. That region is actively mobilizing against a massive copper and gold mine, which would be developed by Sagittarius Mines Incorporated.
And where are they from?
Mining company. Actually, Philippine company, likely with backing from other corporations. And, you know, copper being a critical piece of so-called green energy revolution. Feeding into that whole industry,
both traditional and green, and copper is
a key
mineral. But we'll get into that if we have time.
So anyway, like people organizing against this open pit mining project, which would just have horrendous consequences for the land, for the indigenous people whose land it is. Mindanao is home to roughly 14 different indigenous communities, also known as Lumad peoples. And they have been fighting to protect their land for centuries, and now in the face of increasing mining and agricultural exploitation, are increasingly under threat.
And some of you out there might actually remember I had some Lumad. There was a delegation came to Portland, had a going around the United States a number of years ago. I can't remember exactly when. Actually, had them in the studio here, and I believe one of them actually played a musical instrument, if I recall correctly. Anyway, that was quite quite an amazing experience. They were they've been indigenous people around the world fight so many different layers of oppression. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I can share a little bit about, I was in a different group that was closer to the capital, Manila, actually. So the region called Southern Tagalog, which is a few different provinces, Cavite and Rizal, again, all kind of within a few hours of Manila. But, so we were actually working with kind of, they call them like urban poor folks who, people here might just refer to it as like a slum, but it's basically like, informal communities that are right behind kind of major thoroughfares and streets. And you know, so that land for them is valuable, but it's also valuable to people who want to redevelop, right? So it's just a land grabbing, basically, which happens across the country. in rural areas, it looks different than in urban areas, but it's the same connected to the same economic issues. So what we heard about was communities facing what they call hot demolitions, which is basically arson. So local government folks will work with developers to say like, hey, you know, we want this land, but we need to clear these people out. So they'll pay either local community members or, you know, goons, basically, to go in and burn people's houses down. I mean, it's crazy. And because the settlements are so dense, so closely packed, you know, a fire in one house can easily spread to other houses. And the impact of that is just obviously immense. And part of the issue, too, is that the nature of keeping people in such deep poverty helps governments like be able to pay people off. So sometimes they'll pay people to burn their own houses, which is heartbreaking, you know. And that's part of what organizers on the ground are trying to do, is like work with people to say, how do we build systems of community support so that people don't have to be doing this, you know, and things like that. So that was kind of what we heard a little bit about in one community. Other communities are facing development aggression through like expansion of suburbs, basically. So again, kind of informal settlements that are getting kind of squeezed from these subdivisions that are expanding for, you know, this like theoretical middle class that's a very small percentage of the overall population. But yeah, they're getting cut off from access to water, access to electricity. We were in one community where they literally, the community was kind of in this weird in-between area, in-between suburbs. And at night, the company that owned the road outside of this community would lock the gates. And so in order for them to get into their own houses, they had to crawl through basically a drain pipe. Like, you know, imagine like a 4-foot in diameter concrete pipe. That was their access to their own community. I mean, so it's criminal to see this type of thing happen. And it's all for the sake of land grabbing and for development in that way. And the other, we got to go to a fisher folk community. So kind of a coastal community. That was facing the same type of land grabbing demolition. One area actually earlier this year, the demolition crew showed up with like 50 police. So the Philippine National Police, who the U.S. sponsors with the military funding, showed up and started, you know, shooting at people. And the community defended themselves by setting up a barrier made out of like a basically bushes that had thorns on them. So like, you know, really low tech stuff here. And we're actually able to kind of resist that push, but like six people ended up getting shot. One of them was a pregnant woman, and you know, all of them were arrested and all this stuff. So this is like the type of kind of direct violence that people face daily for literally asserting their right to the land that they've been on for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years and things like that. So, yeah.
So we do have another caller. I know we absolutely have to get to the Philippines Human Rights Act and other things that people can do and some of the organizing that you're doing here in Portland still. But let's go to our next and maybe our last caller. Adriana, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, well, that was going to be my question. I was just wondering, since you just mentioned how the U.S. was supporting those police and military forces, if there's anything that, you know, us in Portland can do to help stop the U.S. from doing that.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking that. So yeah, like Paul mentioned as well, the Philippine Human Rights Act is a crucial piece of legislation that we in the U.S. have the responsibility to make sure that it passes. And so this is this would suspend U.S. military aid. Copeland mentioned this, but the U.S. provides millions of dollars of aid that goes directly to the Philippine National Police and the Armed Forces of the Philippines, which are directly responsible for many of these human rights abuses, extrajudicial killings, red tagging, and harassment of the Filipino people. And so the U.S. is completely complicit in and responsible for these abuses that are going on, and we have a responsibility as taxpayers here to end this. And the Philippine Human Rights Act would suspend all U.S. military aid, including weapons sales to the Philippines, until these human rights abuses end and responsible parties are held accountable. Currently, it's being sponsored in the House by Representative Susan Wild of Pennsylvania, and we have our Oregon representatives Suzanne Bonamici and Earl Blumenhauer have co-sponsored it. It has not yet been introduced in the Senate, and we are working here as local organizers to push our Senator Jeff Merkley to sponsor it in the Senate. Currently, he's been resistant to doing so, despite all the evidence that shows just the horrendous ways that this money is being used, you know, all of the things that we've mentioned, from harassment of people standing up to defend their lands, workers who are being targeted for organizing, indigenous people who are being killed for defending their lands from mining, as well as from there was just a massacre in February of this year of five volunteer teachers and healthcare workers who are involved in indigenous schools in Mindanao, which are schools set up because the government itself does not provide education for a lot of these rural communities. And so these are Lumad schools set up for the indigenous people, run by the indigenous people and volunteers serving the communities. And they are also red tagged and harassed.
Again, red tag means?
Red tagging is the method that the government uses to call organizations and individuals terrorist or communist, and thereby put a target on their back. So the armed forces, as well as other bodies, will routinely red tag individuals to do this. And we saw the results. So a volunteer teacher named Chad Book was red tagged multiple occasions for his work serving indigenous communities in the Philippines, and he was murdered along with four others this February by the armed forces, once again being funded by the U.S. Tax dollars. So it's our responsibility to pass this legislation. Organizations here on the ground are working hard to make sure that this gets through. We have a lot of work to do, but we encourage all of you who are concerned about this both to call your senator, Jeff Merkley in particular, to urge him to sponsor this legislation, as well as to get involved in an organization. So we know that that's where our power comes from, not as individual voters per se, but as people who are organized in their communities, who are exercising the people power and standing up for rights here and around the world. And so you know, joining an organization like PCHIRP, like Kalikasan Solidarity Organization, or like many of the Philippine organizations, if you're Filipino, organizations like Anak Bayan, Gabriela, Migrante, we'll link all these orgs in our show notes so you have access to that. But there's lots of work happening locally on this issue.
Yeah, so go to kboo.fm. Wednesday Talk Radio, and you can the show name of the show is is Organizing for Philippine Solidarity is the name of this program. And yeah, let's go ahead, Copeland, and then I had a kind of a big picture question to close out with.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so I'll just follow up on a couple other things that are coming up. So in general, you know, ICHIRP, the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines, is the global formation that called for this observer's mission. But the country chapter, ICHIRP US, also does a ton of the heavy lifting in terms of coordinating these campaigns. So, you know, they're kind of with the member organizations are really pushing this PHRA campaign. But there's also other political campaigns that they're launching. So there's one called the Dirty Dozen, which is looking at individual sanctions on the people in the Philippines ones who are directly involved in the carry out of these types of extrajudicial killings and the basis for red tagging and all of these things. So that's a campaign that folks could get involved with. But overall, just really want to encourage people who are part of organizations or, you know, individuals to find local iChirp chapters. There's iChirp Portland. There's an iChirp Seattle. There's other regional formations around the country. So there's lots of ways that we can actually get you plugged in. Locally in Portland, there is actually People State of the Nation mobilization coming up. So the details will be finalized soon, but would really encourage people to show up for that. That's really, you know, mass mobilizations are one of the ways that we can really show people power. You know, in the Philippines, for PSONA, they mobilize like hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, it's really a spectacle. You know, look it up on YouTube or something, but then also come out. That happens in late July, so it'll be in a couple weeks, the 24th, I think. So get connected to, you know, again, the organizations here, and we can give you more information, but we'd love to have folks out there. If you're part of a church group or anything like that, then, you know, there's really a place for you, and we need people on the ground to show up with us. So just wanted to make that plug too.
Okay, so the Philippines is a long way away. And obviously for Philippine Americans, all these are really, really close to home. And but for the average person listening to this show, it might seem like a long way away. But on the other hand, with the U.S.-China relations, with the, you know, this whole, I mean, this is huge. The whole, in terms of geopolitics, it's ultimately, I think, bigger than the U.S.-Russia relationship in some ways. Although with the Ukraine war, that's become a huge flashpoint right now. But it's just getting bigger and bigger. And the Philippines is in a really crucial geopolitical place. And I know it's had conflicts over South China Sea and various things with China over the years. So I guess my thing is, seeing how Biden is sort of really retrograde on foreign policy. Now he's visiting Saudi Arabia. So there seemed to be something of a movement building to actually rein in U.S. Funding for the Saudi war machine, especially over the war in Yemen. And that seems to be going back on that. So, I mean, what chance is there really of passing something where the Philippines is of such great geopolitical significance right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a great question because, you know, interestingly, when we were campaigning for the PHRA before the Biden-Harris administration was elected, organizers in California approached Kamala Harris and asked, like, will you sponsor the PHRA? And she straight up said no. Because of the basis of we need a presence in Southeast Asia, right? And that's always been the basis for the strategic launching point into Southeast Asia. And so, you know, I think I think we need to be realistic about the limits of legislative practice. It's one of the tactics that we can use to really push. You know, if it passes, that's amazing, but that's also still not the end of the fight, right? So I think what we're seeing now and the jockeying with China and these different things really puts the Philippines in that like weird geopolitical middle ground. You know, you mentioned the South China Sea, which actually, you know, is the West Philippine Sea. And that was one of the things that people criticized Duterte for, was not standing up for the ICC ruling that said that the Philippines was right to claim that as the West Philippine Sea. And so, you know, he's not even willing to sort of push back on that for national sovereignty, kind of in service of an imperialist power in China. And so I think, yeah, we can be realistic that we don't necessarily see the legislative fight as the end-all be-all. I think it really is, it has to be sort of the fight against the bigger systemic issues like the imperialism and things like that. And I think, you know, you mentioned that the Philippines is a long ways away, but there are issues that connect us. I think one of the ones that stood out to me was contractualization, which is the practice of making contracts for workers that don't give like full benefits. It allows the employer to hire and fire at will. And so often in the Philippines, that looks like hiring people at super cheap rates for a few months, firing them, then they're forced to look for other jobs or get rehired for lower wages. And that's actually happening in the U.S. too. I mean, that was the whole thing with Whole Foods a handful of years ago, like they were doing stuff like that. And so I think, you know, it does feel a long ways away, but the economic basis of those things, the kind of economic realities for people are actually connected to these same systems. So I think we really need to like study those systems and find the ways to push back against it as much as possible.
And we got to close, but, you know, how about like a united anti-imperialist front?
Oh yeah, I mean that sounds good.
I mean, really, you know, with there's Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. There's this resurgence in Latin America of, you know, anti-imperialism. Basically, it seems like maybe a better time than others in the past. Who knows?
Yeah, and I think that's what the National Democratic Movement in the Philippines has been really good at. Some of the organizations as well are connected with the International League of People's Struggles, which organizes movements throughout the world under an anti-imperialist lens. We also work closely with Palestinian liberation organizations here locally, and so all these struggles really are connected, and the Philippines is one example, and also in one, you know, very, very clear and blatant example of U.S. imperialism globally.
Okay, well, that's got to wrap it up. Thank you very much, Copeland Downs and Gabe Pank. It's been wonderful.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right, and thanks for listening. I'm Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9.